they were transmitting, because you would see that light up on top of the antenna. Do you know anything about that, Dick? I don't know any. I remember it, but I don't remember what exactly that was. Probably something from Radio Shack. Back to you.
Yeah, what's really lighting up a fluorescent tube when you hold it near an antenna or near an RF circuit is an interesting question. The fluorescent tube contains mercury vapor inside, and in some cases very little energy is required to ionize that mercury vapor. It puts out a tiny amount of ultraviolet energy, which hits the phosphor that's on the inside of the glass, and the phosphor then starts giving off light. So the RF energy is not creating the light directly. It's an indirect process by way of the vapor that's inside the tube that's really doing all the work. I think that's part of the question you were asking. In reality, I think you were asking a little bit more than that. So I think it's KC2HBR. John, repeat your question with slightly different wording, and maybe I'll get what you're really asking this time. Back to you, John. K2RIW, please wait for the beeps.
Right, this is KC2HBR. Well, Dick, what I was asking you is, what were those little lights that they were attaching to the top of these mobile antennas? So this way you would know they were transmitting. When we'd be driving around, you'd just be able to tell, like, oh, wow, Freddy's transmitting, because you'd see that little light on top of the 9-foot whip. They would add it to the whip. It wasn't like you would buy it like that. So my question is, what was that little light? I mean, was that a little fluorescent light, or what was that little thing that they would add to the top of the antenna to let you know, like, it wasn't anything other than just like something cool, like, wow, look, when I transmit, that little light on top of my antenna lights up, you know? So my question is, what was that light? Have you ever seen anything like that? Over.
NY2H.
Yes, I have. They're called NE2 neon bulbs. It's a bulb that's about creates of an inch or half an inch long, two little leads coming out of the bottom of it. It's a neon bulb that runs on, if you put approximately 65 volts across those two leads, it will give you a purplish glow. And I'm guessing these are NE2. They used to be easy to buy at Radio Shack in the old days, or at Lafayette Radio. I don't know where you buy NE2 neon bulbs these days. Lou, NY2H, tell us your words on this one. K2RIW, you got it, Lou.
Hey, good evening. Yeah, exactly right, NE2s. They used to put them on top of the antennas. And no fluorescent coating or anything. Clear glass, as you said, and there were two rods internally parallel with the neon filled inside, and you would get that kind of orange glow from the RF, and yeah, that's exactly what they were. I remember them, NE2s.
What's your guess, Lou, as to where we would go these days to get NE2 bulbs? The ones I've got are from the year one, you know, zillions of years old, and the neon inside, as long as there's voltage across it, and when you're a fraction of an inch away from a radiating antenna, there's also all kinds of local voltage across the neon bulb itself. Even though you've got the two leads of the neon bulb wrapped around the metal of the antenna, and you got it held on with scotch tape or something like that, some way you're physically holding the neon bulb near the antenna. And whether or not you connect the two wires coming out of it to the metal of the antenna or not, almost doesn't matter. A little bit of experimentation. And where you put the neon bulbs, if you put them at the base of a quarter wave antenna, it probably wouldn't light. As you move them up the antenna near the high voltage point at the tip, you'll get it to light much more easily, and maybe even too bright at your particular power level where the neon bulb wouldn't last very long. So there's an ideal location somewhere along the antenna where you locate the neon NE2. November Echo number 2 is the nomenclature. That's the model number of these little bulbs. And there probably are a number of other brands of neon bulbs. I remember seeing bigger ones with a bayonet socket. Physically, it's a little bit kludgy, but I think that would also work. So there are probably other kinds of neon lighting fixtures we can lay our hands on. So I'm going to pass that back to you, Lou. Where do I get any twos these days? And do you know of other kinds of neon bulbs that, even though they might be larger, that we can get our hands on? NY2H, K2RIW, you got it, Lou.
Yeah, okay, Dick. Well, I would go to the internet to see if it's still available or not. That's, you know, I haven't seen them for a while, but, yeah, I remember them clearly. And, I was only, there was some band radios, and, you know, the illegal 5-watt radios, they would work. So, and, yeah, the other thing is, it reminds me of the, I forget the fellow's name, but he does the demonstration on the Yagi, and he uses the fluorescent tubes. And, you know, he'll put a main element, and then he'll put a reflector on it, and you'll see the increase, and then he'll put a director on it, you know, and you'll see the increase well over the driven element alone, and he'll wrap the fluorescent around. Something happened here. I think I just rebooted. Anyway, I forgot his name, but, I gotta go to my other rig here. Something's going on here. I think I have a loose power cable. But yeah, back in the day, it was the NE2. You hit the nail on the head there. And I would Google them and see if they're still around. You know, I'm sure it'll pop up high on the search if they're available. Back to net.
Those neon NE2 tubes, little bulbs, were so desirable. You got the right suggestion. Somewhere on the internet, somebody is still building those and still selling them. And even if they're not still building them, somebody's got a box full of them and he's willing to sell them. And in the day, I think they used to sell for numbers like, you know, 30 cents a piece or what have you. So now that you know you're looking for neon bulbs, there are ways you can make light-emitting diodes with a rectifier added to them light up with very small amounts of RF. But in the case of making some kind of an arrangement of a light-emitting diode that you can put on the antenna, that's a tough one. Let me think about that. It's worth a try. It's worth a try. We did, at the factory I was working at, we did use light-emitting diodes with a tiny little Schottky rectifier connected to it, to a piece of wire acting as an antenna, and we would use that as an RF field strength indicator. But we never really connected it to the WIP antenna like we're talking about right now. So when you do get an answer to this one, it's a very desirable project, as I see it, John. I think the antenna on my car, I'd like to add neon bulbs. I'm glad somebody told me about this. I've heard stories about that. I'd like to do it. And maybe we all ought to start doing it. We'll start a trend here on the East Coast. KC2, HBR, K2RIW. You got it, John. Glad you brought that to our attention.
WA2VDH with a comment on the neon.
VDH, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm looking in the Jameco catalog. This is a 2017 catalog, but I'm pretty sure they still carry it. They have the little neon bulbs. The only addition is that they've added a 46K resistor in series with one of the leads, but it looks exactly like the old NE2s that we all remember fondly from the 60s. They have them there for about 29 cents in single pieces. I have a Jameco part number if you want it, but I'm pretty sure Jameco still carries it. Go ahead.
That sounds very good, John. So I'm glad it exists. And yes, the reason for that series resistor is that if you were foolish enough to take the neon bulb, where the neon inside, when you exceed about 65 volts, the neon lights up, and it's a negative resistance material. It'll light up dimly at 65 volts, and you go to 67 volts, and now it's super bright, and you go to 75 volts, and you're burning it out. So if you made the mistake of connecting it directly across the 110-volt line, you would kill it. By way of the series resistor, the current it draws when it hits its ionizing voltage automatically limits. I think it's something like a 30K resistor or something like that in series. And you can put AC into it. When you put positive voltage on the right-hand side, that tube inside the neon bulb is the one that lights up. When you put negative voltage, the other one lights up. So when you're using 110-volt AC, to your eye, it looks like both of them are lighting simultaneously. They're really alternating. But that series resistor is to stop you from exploding it and blowing it out if you put the full 110 volts across something that only wants to see 67 volts, so to speak. You might have some further words on this one. I guess it's John. WA2VDH, K2RIW, you got it, John?
Yeah, fine, this is Dick. Yeah, that's exactly what they have. It's a 46K resistor, but yeah, it's designed to be a replacement for 125-volt pilot light. But it is the same, they have a little figure of it. It is the same little NE2 and just a little 46K series resistor. It looks like a quarter watt, so that you could dump it right across, the incoming AC on a chassis and have it as a pilot light. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are a number of rigs that have pilot lights that are really running with an incandescent bulb, and it's only a matter of time before the incandescent bulb burns out. And sometimes the incandescent bulb is no longer available. And by substituting a neon bulb, other than the fact that the color is going to be very different, at least you've got a local source of light and you can see what's going on with your instrument panel. And you got to worry about the fact that the voltage is very different in some cases. But with a little bit of rewiring, you can restore a instrumentation front panel bulb that blew out on you. Okay, let's see if John's got any further words on... Well, wait a minute now. This all started from HBR asking us a question, but it really was Roy's time that we're eating into. Roy, sorry we're taking the wind out of your sails. AC2GS, K2RIW, Roy. Are you going to put neon bulbs on your antennas also? We can see them on the top of the roof of your house. You got it, Roy.
I don't think so, Dick. I tend to try and do a stealth operation here. I don't want my neighbors looking up in the sky and wondering what's going on. Thankfully, people don't really look up, so my antennas have not been a problem. I don't want to draw any attention to them whatsoever. I got a message from KC2UPS via EchoLink. He gave me a link to a company called Jackson Lighting and Electric Company. Jackson Lighting and Electric Supply, that sells NE2 tubes for 28 cents a piece without the voltage limiting, current limiting resistor. I even have some NE2s sitting in my parts supply, and I have a very poor selection of parts in my parts supply. So they tend to be ubiquitous as far as I know. And of course, YouTube has a lot of things related to this. There are more than a few videos of how to turn LEDs into a similar device to light up your antenna, and there are sites that sell professional lit whips for motorcycles and other strange things.
Boy, that's good to know. Thank Rich to UPS for giving us that information. So, other people have made their antennas light up when RF energy is there. And so you're saying there are YouTube videos telling you how to do it. And there's even ways of doing it with light-emitting diodes. I don't think you can do it directly with the light-emitting diode. I think you have to put a rectifying diode with the light-emitting diode. But you can give me a repeat on that one, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW.
I haven't really seen it. I just looked it up and found it. It might require a separate diode, but it might use a string of LEDs, and one of them may be used as that diode that's necessary. So there's probably more than a few different ways of skinning that cat.
Yeah, what I was worried about is that in the case of an NE2 neon bulb, That little, those rods inside the neon are really lighting on each half cycle of the RF. The neon lights that rapidly. Whereas in the case of a light emitting diode, can they be turned on and off rapidly with a pulsing circuit, you know, sending Morse code easily, with voice easily. But at the RF frequency of, say, 14 megacycles, can you turn on a light emitting diode 14 on and off 14 million times per second? I'm a little worried about that on certain brands of light emitting diodes. I don't think they can handle that frequency and respond to it. I'd like to be wrong in that one. I wish we could find a inexpensive light emitting diode that when the RF energy hits it, it works on the RF energy directly. It'll respond that well. I'm worried that the light emitting diode has enough capacitance across its terminals that not enough the RF energy really gets to the active diode itself. That's for further experimentation. We gotta hold our light emitting diodes near our antenna and see if we can make it light up. AC2GS K2RIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. By the way, this is AC2GS. Also, I want to have everyone keep in mind, John from Los Alamos is listening to us on IRLP, and I think he wanted to say something about one of the subjects lately, but we didn't quite give him enough time to key up. So maybe we could pause audio for a little while and give John in Los Alamos a chance to key up.
Let's do that.
Yes, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Roy. Real quick, I won't take long, and a simple yes or no would be sufficient, but I'm sure you're familiar with these RF probes that companies like HP, Agilent, and the like make, where it has a very tiny amplifier basically right near the tip and a very small interaction with the RF circuit. Could one of these touch the end of an antenna and give you the indication you need to know how it's working? Or would that be just your body and the probe too close to it's radiating? Where normally these are used in circuit, a non-radiating circuit, could you use these in a radiating circuit and would it be useful? I guess I'll give it over to Dick. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
You blow it out.
Well, there's ways you could shield it. They make a kind of a circuit which has a field effect transistor with a little piece of wire. A field effect transistor has got an input impedance on its gate that's many megohms. So that when you hold this circuit, it's a handheld object with a battery inside and a light-emitting diode fired by the field effect transistor. When you hold it near a 110-volt circuit, say, for instance, you got a piece of a twin lead with 110 volts on it, and one side of the twin lead, zip cord. One side of the zip cord is hot with 110 volts, and the other side is returned. It's grounded. And as you hold it near the hot side, you get the light-emitting diode comes on, and during the other, hold it near the other side, the light-emitting diode goes off. This circuit is great for looking at series string Christmas tree lights and finding out which ones have voltage and which one don't have voltage, and you can find the bad voltage, bad bulb right away. So that circuit works on local capacitive sensing of 60 cycle, 110 volts. Could an RF version of that be made? Could an RF version of that be made? Absolutely. Would the one that's designed for 60 cycles work with RF without modification? There I'm worried. So you can see what I'm worried about on that one. I guess I'll turn it back to Mr. SHO, KC2SHO. Go ahead. I've forgotten your name, K2RIW. You got it, Los Angeles, Los Alamos.
Yeah, no worries, Dick. John here. Well, I didn't really have anything else. I was thinking about those probes and thinking about the issue you were talking about and wondering if they'd be useful there. I've never tried it. I've had those probes in my hand so many times working in the circuit. Of course, we're always doing very low-level stuff, probing around, and those don't handle much power, you know. But if you were just testing an antenna with a low-power transmitter, perhaps there would be something there, and I'd be curious to how to shield that, but we can save that for another time. I know you guys are trying to move on. No worries at all. Always enjoyable hearing the net. I've been away most of the summer just because of time, and we still have daylight here. You know, for us, your net comes on at 6 o'clock, so that's still quite a bit of a day left for us. Anyway, I'll let you get back to the net. Thank you so much, and look forward to maybe talking more in the future. K2RIW and EC2... Oh. Well, I forget Roy's call all of a sudden. Something with the GS. Anyway, have a good evening, gentlemen, and we'll talk more soon.
Very fine, John. That sensing circuit of yours is a little bit expensive and a little bit bulky. You wouldn't be attaching it to the whip of an antenna. And a guy who's putting a neon bulb on his antenna, an E2, he's probably going to put three or four of them. He doesn't want to have just, in some cases, he doesn't want to have just one little light. In some cases, he wants multiple lights, even though they're going to be a little bit different in brilliance. The neon bulb at 30 some odd cents is so inexpensive that you don't worry about it, whereas that detecting circuit you're talking about, that's a real piece of test equipment. It's got some bulk to it, and it's got some dollars of value. You're not going to be connecting that to an antenna. To test that an antenna has RF while the finger's in your hand, yes. But to connect it permanently to the antenna so when you're driving around, people know that RF energy is coming out of the antenna, that's not quite the right one, I think. But we've opened up a beautiful subject here of visualizing the RF energy on the antenna. And so the neon bulbs probably is the best visualization in the world. And by putting neon bulbs on the four different whips, as you go to the four different bands and look at the different whips lighting up with the neon bulbs, boy, that would be a fun project. Can you visual that one now, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yeah, that would be a great one. I have to do a little bit of a YouTube search to see if someone's done anything similar. Somehow, it seems like every idea has been tried. I know I saw a very interesting YouTube with an amateur radio operator maker called Jerry Ellsworth working with magnetic loops, and she was using a neon bulb to demonstrate the voltage potential differences across the loop. So I'm going to have to do a deep dive in YouTube and see if anyone's done this before.
Sounds like a lot of fun. I hope somebody has done it, but if not, maybe we should do it. You got it, Roy.
Indeed, and worst comes to worst, we could ask Chris to borrow that antenna if he actually purchases it. So that'll be fun. Would you like your second mailbag question for the night?
Sure would. Yeah. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, this is from a guy who's who really seems to like the technical net, and he's in the chat room very often. And unfortunately, I believe he lives in Connecticut, so he can't really listen to us directly. He listens off of a link. His name is Joe. His call sign is AA2IT. And his question is, in an attempt to improve my reception of the technical net, I purchased a six-element Yagi at the flea market this very morning, the nutmeg market that we talked about earlier. It is designed for 144.1 megahertz. He asks, what do I need to do in order to get it to work for 146.25 megahertz? He says, the reflected power rises sharply beyond 144.88 megahertz and is 3 to 1 at 146.25. He says it has a T-match. So that's his question for tonight.
Yeah, unfortunately, he's going up in frequency, which is the more difficult direction. If he was taking an antenna on 146 and moving it down to 144, adding gimmick capacitors in the right spot would bring it down very easily on the individual elements, the tips of the individual elements. So going down is easy. going up as hard. And at first you'd think, well, chopping off some of the length of the elements. But that's a destructive process, and it's very hard to go back. Not so hard. So chopping off the right length of each of the elements. The nice thing about Yagi antennas is that everything is proportional. If you're moving the frequency 1% higher in frequency, and you shorten every element by 1% in length, in my example, you would be on the new frequency. So by calculating percentage of frequency difference, which in this case is around 1.5%, I'm guessing, 2 megs out of 146, yeah, it's around 1.5%. So by shortening the length by 1.5%, the elements, you will be moving up in frequency. If you go too far and you cut off too much, that's not the end of the world. You can always electronically add the length back by putting a little piece of copper tape near the tip of the element and bending it just right. You can tune it, so to speak, with a little rubber stick, with a wooden stick standing off at a long distance. There probably are ways you can shunt an inductor. Now, that's too difficult. There are other ways of raising the frequency, but it's nowhere near as easy as chopping it off. So chopping off length is my recommendation. I'll admit it. It looks destructive. I can see a person with the with the side cutters in his hand. He's about to cut the length of an element, and he's a little bit nervous about it because if he's got to add it back, adding a small piece of small diameter tubing near the end of the element, and telescoping tubing and sliding it, you can always get the length back again if you go too far. That's about the only way I can think of. I mean, zigzagging the element. Let me drop. You know, putting bends in the element to zigzag it. Believe it or not, although you're physically shortening it, you're electronically lengthening it, and the electronic lengthening dominates, so that wouldn't do it. I'll think about this some more, but going higher in frequency is a more difficult direction. I think you got to do it by trimming, by cutting. I know that's not a pleasant answer. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
KD2FIU.
Let's see how George does it. Go ahead, George.
We don't know if there is near-field grounding that is causing the roll-off as it goes higher in frequency.
Negative. No. Any reasonable distance that you're locating a dipole, a Yagi antenna, the local environment is not changing its resonant frequency. If you were taking your Yagi antenna and placing it 1 foot against above a great big sheet of metal, yes. But we never operate a Yagi that way. So what you're saying is good common sense, George, but I think it's very unlikely in this case. Back to you for any rebuttal on that one, George. Go ahead.
I did open up saying we don't know if there is any near-field grounding causing a roll-off at the higher frequency. We don't know.
Agreed. I also don't know whether or not red paint is dripping off the antenna. Both cases are very unlikely, in my opinion. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good. I think that's as good an answer as any. There's no magic solution, unfortunately, to an ever so slightly non-resonant radiating structure. By the way, Chris mentioned in the chat room that he just ordered that half-wave vertical antenna from Whistler, and he says if we want to experiment with it, we're more than welcome. So that sounds like we might have a little job in the future.
Looking forward to it. Whistler, here we come. And maybe he's going to add some neon bulbs to it, because he'd like to see which of the four wires are lighting up as he goes to each of the frequencies. You got it, Roy.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Now, he just bought that antenna. It must have a brand name. It must have been probably set up for 2 meters initially. So, you know, you could probably find that antenna on the internet, and the original instructions on how to put it together
although he said he had a T match. I have a gamma match on mine, and they tell you exactly, you know, where to place it for what frequency you're looking for, you know, when you set up the gamma match. I would think it, look up the original manual, if you can find that, and see what they did. Back to you, Dick.
Well, there's a slim chance we're mixing together here two separate antennas. One is a Whistler antenna with four whips to it, and the other one is a Yagi antenna that we're trying to move up in frequency. So there's two separate items going on here, I think. I might be wrong on that one. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick. I think Paul's alluding to not the Whistler, but Joe AA2IT's a question about his Yagi, that maybe there's something in the instructions for that Yagi of how to change the match somehow. And as an aside, it would be nice if Chris could do that experiment. Unfortunately, since he doesn't have a license yet, he can't really transmit. Maybe he can transmit on the marine band, but otherwise not. So that's going to require him to pass a license or to bring it over to one of us. And in addition, someone posted in the chat room a link to YouTube that looks like it's showing a very nice demonstration of standing waves. I'm sure you've seen things like that. I've seen them in the past. Those little pendulum devices that kind of demonstrate wave phenomena on a visual, image for videos and such. So I haven't seen this particular one, but it looks like it might be interesting.
Yeah, that torsional main rod with a whole bunch of Yagi elements on it, a zillion Yagi elements that demonstrate standing waves and waves are being properly impedance matched. That's a nice old YouTube video, but that's operating at the sub-audio frequencies. That thing doesn't work at RF frequencies. Really directly viewing RF. Other than the neon bulbs, I don't know of any good way to do it today without that the sheet of material that changes color when it absorbs RF energy that you lay against the antenna, which is something you cannot purchase yet. Although I know somebody was working on it a few years ago. How about you, Roy? K2RIW.
Well, who knows what science talk I'll report that invention one of these days. You never know. As an aside, Joe AA2IT in the chat room thanks Paul, but he mentions that he has the original manual, and it is definitely made for 144.1 megahertz, and there's no frequency change instructions in the manual.
That doesn't surprise me. An antenna designed for 144.1 is designed for the CW portion of the band, the really serious guys down there that are looking for maximum gain, reasonable standing wave ratio, and they rarely go much higher in frequency. So I think there's no good solution other than a trimming. But if you do everything with the same percentage, and you don't have to worry about the change in percentage of the spacing between the elements, it's only the element length that you have to adjust the length of. And you do it in a percentage manner, you will arrive at the new frequency a hell of a lot better than you would expect. Over to you, Roy. K2RIW.
Good. Well, I hope that Joe has written down all these things, and I wish him good luck, and I'm sure he'll let me know how things are going. By the way, the chat room is a lively thing tonight. I probably should mention it at the beginning of my talks more regularly. We have something like seven people on tonight, which is very nice. And Joe, by the way, thanks you via the chat room.
I wonder if they all get attracted by the battery questions. We're always, as portable electronic operators, we all just love batteries. And I'm still amazed that people will tolerate a cell phone that has to be charged every single day. And how they can tolerate such small battery capacities. I'd want to always carry something else that can give me a much longer life. You've got it, Roy.
Oh, Oh, yes, indeed. Unfortunately, batteries is technology's Achilles heel. It really hasn't kept up with most of the other technologies, even though probably I won't get to that particular news item. Who knows? But part of the news items are that the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was won for the invention and optimization of lithium-ion batteries.
Yeah, you did get a pretty big jump in ampere hours per pound or ampere hours per cubic foot, per cubic inch, per cubic centimeter, with lithium-ion batteries, lithium polymer, lithium-ion. Lithium is a much higher energy density battery, but still, that was like a, I'm guessing, a 2-to-1 increase in capacity. We really need a 100-to-1 increase. We've got to find some kind of a battery technology that can give us 100 times more than we've got right now. Otherwise, our electric automobiles, an electric automobile that drives only 50 miles scares people. They're afraid of buying it and running out of juice. An electric automobile that can go to 1,000 miles, we'd all buy that right away if it wasn't too high in price. You got it, Roy. Take your eyes out of here. We need a better battery to make that happen.
AC2GS. I agree with you entirely, Dick, and it's a shame you can't just vote for these things and have them magically appear. Almost every week I have to decide whether or not to choose on some article about a slightly newer battery technology. They're trying a lot of interesting things with graphene. They're trying a lot of things with kind of graphene analogs, molybdenum sulfate, and other things that have somewhat similar metamaterial structures. So they're talking about supercapacitors taking charges in seconds or minutes and having a higher energy density than we think is possible with these right now, present technology. So, the future is going to be an interesting thing to live through.
More power to you.
Indeed, wired, wireless, AC, DC, no matter what, we need power. It's so strange, the holidays just are over, and to kind of, I take the opportunity to get a sense of what it was like to be in the 1900s, and it's not fun being in the 1900s.
By the way, you and I try to be scientists, and we just use the word power. We're making a slight error. It's energy. It's watt hours of energy in the battery you and I care about. The fact that the battery can, for a short period of time, put out 500 watts, that's nice. If it can put out 500 watts for an hour, we're talking about, that's energy. So we're looking for batteries with greater energy capacity. Over to you, Roy, KTRIW.
Indeed, Dick, and that's what confuses a lot of people. You know, they look at the ratings for lead acid batteries and even lithium iron phosphate batteries to a degree, and they try and make sense of these amp hour numbers. These amp hour numbers are kind of on a more of a theoretical basis than on a practical basis. It's highly dependent upon how you squeeze the energy out of the battery, and almost no one does it with 100% efficiency. So most of these numbers that we see listed are kind of very optimistic, to say the very least.
Yeah, as you draw more and more current out of the battery, the voltage drops to a lower number, the internal resistance starts becoming more significant, and it gives an energy dissipation within the battery itself. So if you want maximum watt hours or ampere hours out of the battery, you draw very, very little current. But that's not the way you run your electronics. Over to you, Roy, KTRIW.
Indeed, and there's so many variables about batteries, and the different types have different characteristics. One of the reasons I'm a big fan, although it's a little bit overpriced, in lithium iron phosphate, is that as it discharges, the voltage potential doesn't decline as quickly as is seen in lead acid. In lead acid, you can get it to drop below 10 volts, And a lot of our radios really don't like dealing with 9-point-something voltages. They're designed really for 13 and change. And so with lithium iron phosphates, I've had less problems along those lines. But, you know, that's some things you have to kind of understand what's going on in your battery chemistry.
In the case of a lead-acid battery, if you wanted to mount it to the voltage while discharging it, and you want to find out how many ampere hours or what hours you've got, you'd be very tempted to run it all the way down to some very low voltage. Do not do that. In the case of most lead-acid batteries, and probably even true of gel cells, which are a modified version of lead-acid, when the voltage gets down to 12 and below, you're entering the region where you've only got a small percentage of charge left in the battery, and you're entering that region where some permanent damage takes place to the internal chemistry that'll never be restored, per se. So when you're watching the voltage on a battery and you're discharging it, my recommendation is don't go below 12, maybe 11.7, but you know what I mean. Don't go to those lower numbers under a small amount of current output. If the voltage jumps down to some low voltage, like 10 volts, during the time you're running the starter motor at 200 amperes, that's different. But when the voltage out of the terminals gets below 12, you're entering the region of damage to that particular battery, in my opinion. AC2GS, K2IW.
I agree, Dick. Lead-acid cells are inexpensive, relatively low-tech, ubiquitous, and cost-effective for many people. There are designs specifically made for deep discharge versions of lead-acid cells, but it's never a good idea to do a deep discharge on that type of a chemistry. The cathodes get sulfonated, which adds internal resistance and limits current, and there becomes a vicious cycle during the recharge stages that it takes longer and longer to get anywhere close to a recharge. So there are limitations in technology. Lead acid has stayed with us for the longest time. You know, there were lead acid batteries that go back about 150 years or so. It was the first rechargeable battery design that was discovered, invented. Modern technology hopefully will have some better answers these days. Well, that's it for the mailbag tonight. Two mailbag questions. I think I broke a record. I think previously it was the record was one mailbag question. But I thank Chris and I thank Joe for their questions. And please, if you have further questions to ask Dick, and you can't get on to the TechNet itself, please avail yourself of my email address, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Now, I will let it drop, and I will give you my spiel, which will then follow a small puzzler.
And by the way, people who are submitting something to the mailbag, they're not only submitting it to Dick, they're submitting it to Dick, Paul, and Roy. So any of those people are approachable by way of the mailbag. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed, Dick. And if there's one thing you guys should have figured out by now, if you've ever emailed me, is I do actually respond to email a lot and often and somewhat rapidly in almost an obsessive-compulsive sort of way. So if you send me email and you don't get some reply from me rather quickly, I'm asleep or something, because otherwise I will answer you. So please, one and all, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, let me pause a second, and we'll go into the science talk. Okay, tonight's little puzzler has to do with the Big Bang. So I thought it would be nice if I could speak a little bit about it and frame the puzzle a little bit better. Keep in mind that we have no eyewitness accounts for any of this. And there are other somewhat less scientific hypotheses based on secondhand hearsay from claimed eyewitnesses in oral and written tradition. But since this is science talk and not religion talk, we'll save those theories for that particular next. The biggest question is what might or might not have existed before the Big Bang. Local space and time didn't quite seem to exist. So what was that time before time began? Or is time self-contained in small little packages and scattered through a multiverse? For now, we'll let the theoretical physicists and the philosophers and the divinity professors think about that, and we'll just go on to the Big Bang. The smallest bit of time that physicists believe is possible is called a Planck time, which is approximately 10 to the minus 43 seconds. That's 1 with 43 seconds. That's 1 over 1 with 43 zeros seconds. That's a very short amount of time. So one of the first epochs of the Big Bang that's theorized is called the Planck epoch. One Planck second after a quantum fluctuation triggered the Big Bang, our universe is believed to be approximately 10 to the minus 33 centimeters in diameter. That's really, really small. And homogeneous with a temperature of about 10 to the 32 degree Kelvin. Now, some physicists believe that all this intense energy density, at this energy density, all four of the fundamental forces of nature, the strong nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, and gravity, were all of equal magnitude and were somewhat interchangeable due to some form of symmetry that got broken as the temperature dropped in the universe. Let me drop. Then there was the Grand Unification Epoch. That starts from about 10 to the minus 36 seconds to about 10 to the minus 32 seconds, when the force of gravity splits off from the other equivalent forces and elemental particles and their antiparticles begin to come into existence. Then there's the Inflationary Epoch. That stage happens from about 10 to the minus 36 seconds to 10 to the minus 32 seconds. At which time our universe has grown by a factor of 10 to the 26th power, all the way to being roughly the size of a nicely grown grapefruit. It's a hot potato, though. Its temperature at that point is believed to be about 10 to the 28th degrees Kelvin. The strong nuclear force splits off from the remaining equivalent forces during this period. Next big one is the quark epoch. That occurs 10 to the minus 12 seconds to 10 to the minus 6 seconds. Antiquarks, electrons, positrons, quarks, neutrinos, antineutrinos are created from the surrounding energy. And for some still completely unknown reason, about one in every billion antiquarks, for 1 billion antiquarks created, there's 1 billion and one quark created. So at the end of this called baryogenesis, you're left with matter. You're left with quarks as opposed to anti-quarks. Now, why there's that little one in a billion thing, we don't know. Let me drop for a second. Then there's the Hadron epoch. That comes from about 10 to the minus 6 seconds to one entire second, where the universe cools to a balmy trillion degree Kelvin. At these temperatures, the free quarks are able to combine into neutrons and protons, and the free electrons occasionally collide with a proton to form a neutron, and neutrinos are released as part of this melee flying all over the damn place. Next is something called the lepton epoch, which occurs from 1 second to 3 minutes, during which the electron anti-electrons are mutually annihilated, recreated in the background of the young universe's energy density. The same thing that happened to the quarks and the anti-quarks happened to the electrons and the anti-electrons. Out of a billion anti-electrons, there's a billion and one electrons, and in the end of that melee, you're left with that one single electron for every billion. Then there's something called nucleosynthesis, which occurs somewhere between 3 minutes and 20 minutes into the Big Bang, when the background temperature drops to only a billion degrees Kelvin, allowing for nuclear fusion for those free neutrons and protons to form the nuclei of helium and, to a lesser extent, lithium, until the density of the free protons drop below the density needed to maintain nuclear fusion reactions. Then comes the photon epoch, That goes on from 3 minutes to 240,000 years or so, where the universe is dominated by all the photons that remain as they frequently interact with all the plasma made out of all those free electrons, free protons, and free nuclei. That brings us to recombination. From 240,000 years to about 300,000 years, as the universe expands, its average kinetic energy, its temperature drops below the point that sustains the universe with free electrons and protons and nuclei. The opposite charges attract. Neutral atoms now populate our universe, and with no plasma to speak of, these photons are free to fly away uninterrupted forever and ever. Now, these photons born out of the quark epoch and the lepton epoch are our cosmic microwave background. The universe has expanded so much in volume that its present temperature is a very chilly 2.725 degrees Kelvin above absolute zero. So, for tonight's little puzzle, if you will, if you could somehow survive being an eyewitness at the recombination phase when the universe lights up, what do you think the photons might, the characteristic of the photons might be? Do you think you'd be dealing with gamma rays, X-rays, visible rays, microwaves? That's my question for tonight. You're there at the epoch of recombination. Someone said, let there be light, and there was. Is there a color to that light, or...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Hey, I think I got to my question. What do you think is the nature of the microwave cosmic background at the time that it was first visible in the universe?
Plasma. The material that's cooling off is going from a plasma-like stage to a non-plasma-like stage. And, well, this relative plasma density taking place as a function of time is my guess, Roy. And the experience we've got with the ionosphere and also sporadic E-clouds is that the reflection you get from them is a function of frequency squared, I think it is. Yeah. As you go higher in frequency, the plasma becomes more non-reflective. So the higher frequencies, I think, get through the plasma better. So I'm going to guess that the first thing that comes out of there that we can see, out of that soup, are the higher frequencies, the shorter wavelengths, the gamma rays. That's a guess on my part, Roy. Over to you, K2IW.
Okay, I mean, that's a good line of logic. You have to keep in mind, though, that this is the early universe. There are no suns yet. Gravity hasn't had a chance to pull hydrogen clouds together under pressure and temperature that causes nuclear fusion to occur. So all that you have as an energy source is the energy density of the closed system that is our universe. And as it expands, its volume goes down, and its energy density per unit volume diminishes. And it gets to a point where the energy density can no longer keep free electrons free. They're trapped by the electromagnetic force of a proton or a alpha particle nuclei. Well, in a way, it sort of is reminiscent of many times our conversations about whether radio waves are dangerous or not. And the general consensus that I've learned through my years is that as long as it's non-ionizing radiation, it's functionally not terribly dangerous to us. So you have to think in terms of what non-ionizing radiation sort of means.
When you look at the Hubble deep field and ultra deep field, and you look way far in the distance, way back in time, you have a significant number of quasi-stellar objects these early formed objects, which are possibly the beginning of black holes and great big chunks of material, are coming together, emitting an awful lot of gamma rays, I think. So you could make a case for some of the earliest objects are gamma ray emitters when it comes to assemblages of material that eventually is going to later on become stars. Again, a guess on my part. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
I mean, that's a good way of looking at it. Unfortunately, present understanding from physicists is that it took a good 300 million years before the universe cooled down enough and stars formed. And the recombination epoch occurs somewhere between 240 and 300,000 years. So there's not even a proto sun in the sky. It's just at that point it goes from just darkness of plasma to a bright electromagnetic wave hitting everything.
Okay, let me ask this question. I know it's not fair to be asking you questions because you're asking us. What are the characteristics of this material in the beginning that would or would not be frequency selective, wavelength selective? Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, basically high energy alpha particles, protons, and electrons, just running ragged all over the place with an average kinetic energy temperature in the environment in ridiculously high numbers. So it's, you know, all the literature that I've seen never really breaks it down. They just kind of generalize that at those intense energy levels, the plasmas just interact with any electromagnetism that hits it.
Plasma can be an emitter. Plasma can be an absorber. And so if some of the plasma is trying to emit, but it has to get through a cloud that's in front of it, that's an absorber, we've got a conflict going on here. Although black body characteristics usually means that which is capable of emitting is also capable of absorbing, depending on its temperature. I think you're going to have to tell us in this one, Roy. At least many of us, I believe, are not in our area that we've got previous experience. Got it, Roy. I wasn't there.
Neither was I, Dick, and neither was anyone that I know. But again, there's those tall tales and books and oral traditions among some people who talk of turtles and goats and snakes and all kinds of interesting things. I just give everyone else just a chance to, this is not a simple, easy question, but I thought it would be a somewhat thought-provoking question. So anyone else have any kind of thoughts on the subject before I wrap this one up?
VDH with a guess.
That's John.
I'm going to take a guess and say that pretty much it would have to be probably far infrared or maybe near infrared, because nothing much else would get through all of that that plasma soup. I know that infrared tends to penetrate greater distances, you know, to obscuring material. So I'm going to take a guess and say in the infrared. Go ahead.
Okay, John, but the premise I'm trying to get at is what is the recombination phase. You should kind of think of it as having turned the lights off. All of a sudden, all the plasma goes down to the ground state, and you have no plasma anymore. At what average temperature would you think might be associated with that loss of ionization? Ultimately, what it amounts to is, if I had to kind of guess, having not read anything, I would have suggested that it would be somewhere right below ultraviolet, because we've talked repeatedly that at ultraviolet frequencies,